Vanity of vanity, all is vanity. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Yes, I used to shout vanity of vanities, all is vanities, every single time I was picking out a vanity for either a project house or for my own house with my wife. And yes, both my business partner and my wife were always quite embarrassed when I would do that in the middle of a Lowe's. But here's the thing, guys, it was funny every single time. All right. So, I know our last episodes have been running longer and longer, but this one, I'm going to try to keep it kind of short and punchy, if for no other reason than the fact that I have a little, wee, wiggly newborn child named David now, so prayers are certainly appreciated. I hope that despite the recent sleep deprivation, this here episode will make a shred of sense. I think it will. Really, there's just going to be one big point and just a few little bonus points, which we'll be dwelling on. I will be contrasting the message of Ecclesiastes with some of the writings of Paul and with the famous dialogue in the Republic that Plato records talking about the analogy of the cave. I think you're going to see a lot of similarities, and we hope to tease out some cool stuff. If you really, really liked this Ecclesiastes-based episode, I could be persuaded to do a series. I've considered that. Just going to have to have a significant portion of you guys write in and request it, and I'll do it. And of course, if you have any other requests, I'm always open to that. And we are short mailbag questions. I've not been asking for those. So if you have any questions, send them in. Yes, Abby, that means you too. She is the source of oh so many mailbag questions and good ones. So send those in, guys, suggestions, mailbag questions at thegordianknot101@gmail.com. All right, on with the episode. Ecclesiastes. It's a strange book. It has some of the weirdest quotes, and ones which seem like they're just flat out false or in contradiction to plenty of other, at least, emphases in the Bible. It's, for that reason, one of my favorite books to quote, because here are a few of those quotes which really do puzzle people who've been reading the rest of the Bible. Here's one. For in much wisdom is vexation, and those who increase in knowledge increase in sorrow. I don't know a part of the Bible that would directly contradict that, but it doesn't seem to really fit with the rest. Here's another. The dead are better off than the living. Money is an answer to everything. Sorrow is better than laughter. Do not be too righteous, and do not act too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Follow your heart. And, of course, we have, I believe in chapter 8, a recommendation to have a diversified portfolio, where it reads, ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you shall receive a return. Invest in 7 ventures. Yes, in 8. And you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. So there you go, guys. You should engage in trade, arbitrage trade, based on the cost of grain, and expect a return over the course of time. Investing in many ventures, 7, even 8, it says. So that means lots of them, even more, possibly, in order to reduce your risk of ruin when disaster inevitably comes. My grandfather, who is a Baptist preacher, through most of his life, had a favorite passage of the Bible he would always quote. It's from Ecclesiastes. When people would say, what's your favorite verse? He'd go, Well, it's from Ecclesiastes. It's dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a foul odor. And he'd look them dead in the eye, absolute seriousness. And they typically wouldn't realize that he was just kind of kidding and joking. And they'd look for deep meaning in this passage, which there might be some. But yes, that was his favorite verse. Now, I'm not going to go through and unpack all of these or other funny sayings. Instead, we're going to be focusing more than anything else on the one most repeated thing in all of the chapters. And that is the phrase, under the sun. You will hear this qualifier with almost hypnotic regularity as you read. Now, for my quick check, there are 10 categories of things which are called meaningless or vain, and after each, we get that qualifier, under the sun. So, chapter 2, we learned that human wisdom is vain and meaningless under the sun. Labor, And later on in that chapter, we learned that amassing things and possessions, vain. Life itself is vain. Competition and success over other people is vain. Overworking and pushing yourself too hard, that's vain. Power and authority, that's vain. Greed, that's vain. Wealth and accolades, vain. And just perfunctory religious practices, also vain and meaningless. And there may be more, but that's a pretty decent list. So all of this is vain. We have things which are good, things which are bad, things which are in relation to others. All of this called vain when it's under the sun. That part is extraordinarily important. Now, there are a few things which are called not vain. And, well, we can list a few of those as well. But he first gives us a reason for why all of these category things are indeed vain. And that is, towards the end of the book, he explains that they don't last. That's reason number one. Two, the good and bad things are not apportioned to good and evil people according to what they deserve. And the third reason that he cites for why all of these categories of things are vain and meaningless is that they don't ultimately satisfy the desires of man. So they don't last, they're not properly apportioned according to good or evil, and they don't ultimately satisfy. Now the book ends with this editorial explanation, and we'll be picking up in last chapter, verse 9. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many parables, or many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads, and if you're not familiar with a goad, you'd probably know it in another context. It's like something to prod or annoy or bother or kind of push somebody towards something, so you're goading them, right? Their collected sayings, like firmly embedded nails, given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. I think college students would recognize that as extraordinarily true. Now all has been heard. There is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So, we have those goads, things which bother, annoy, or prompt us to go another way. And then we have these nails, which fasten us to something. So, he gives us an idea about what his book is about. His words, his proverbs, are meant to bother you away from those things which are vain and meaningless, and instead to fasten you to what is good. This is what's described as the shepherding action. It's driving us out into a pasture that will ultimately satisfy us, and away from the pasture which cannot and will not. So, where is he driving us? Why is he goading us away from the things specifically under the sun? What does he want to fasten us to? Well, that's answered in that next part of the passage. It says the commandments of God, right? That's something that he wants us to latch on to. And, well, he lists out three different things. So we have the commandments of God being the hope of final judgment and the expectation that we'll one day see and understand these things. Well, those are the three things. Sorry, guys. Sleep deprivation. So, there you go. Those are the three things. One, the following the commands. That relates to the virtue of love. Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And what about the ultimate judgment of good and evil that Solomon points to? Well, that relates to the virtue of hope, where we place our hope in the fact of the resurrection, the final judgment and ultimate vindication by an all-powerful, all-seeing God. And the last part is he talks about what things will ultimately be seen and understood in light of the wrapping up of all of time. And that is the ultimate sight of what is true through the eyes of faith. So eventually we get the sight of what everything means, that faith itself will allow us to behold all of these things. So what he targets to the very end is faith, hope, and love. That is where he wants to drive us. That is that green pasture where this shepherd wishes to take us, so that we don't live a life of toil, in vanity, and in meaninglessness. All right. So that ending line, those ending lines that we just kind of read and broke up, show us that what's purely natural cannot ultimately satisfy, because our yearnings are properly supernatural, and his solutions are not the natural virtues, but the theological virtues, faith, hope, and love. So what is he doing? He's pointing us, bum, 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 to something beyond the natural order. So remember that line, under the sun, all is vanity, under the sun. What is he doing? He's asking us to wonder, to think, to search for the things which are over the sun, beyond the natural order, above just the light that comes down onto their material earth, and think about what is the light of truth that comes from God himself. So if you read this book and you felt depressed, good. What he's doing is he's goading you away from the fields of vanity and existential poverty towards Christ, who fastens himself to the futility of our mortality through the nails driven into the palms of his hands in his ultimate act of religion, worship, and obedience. Religion literally means the tying back onto. The ultimate act of religion is when Jesus is tied to the nail, to the cross, with those nails, the nails which Solomon talks about, ultimately fastening us to what is good and true. Isaiah writes in the words of the Messiah, "Behold, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands." So Solomon would see in Christ the fulfillment of his words in Ecclesiastes, because Jesus died naked, beaten, thirsty, despised and rejected. He confronts the full fury of a world gone mad with vanity and existential poverty. Yet, it's in that act that he finds his ultimate beatitude, one that can be entered into by us if we walk in his footsteps, past the vanities of this life and steadfastly towards God himself. So when Solomon says under the sun again and again, he's prompting us to that wonder about what is beyond the sun, what's above the natural order, what is the pasture that he wishes to shepherd us to, and that the good shepherd, Jesus Christ, ultimately is bringing us to. Well, this reminds me of one of the most famous passages of all of Scripture, and it's from the Psalms. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." It goes on to say, "You lead me beside still waters. You nourish my soul." This, I think, is wrapping up a lot of what we're saying here, that what Jesus is doing is he's bringing us through the valley of the shadow of death, out of the realm of shadows, and to that place of union with God, the verdant pastures, which are watered by the water that comes from Christ's side. Now, the next passage I want to quote you is from the Apostle Paul. Now that we've talked about Ecclesiastes a bit, and we kind of have that in our mind, I want you to look for the very Ecclesiastes-like, something, words, that's present in this passage, because I think it really wraps up the message of Ecclesiastes, but in a new covenant kind of way. All right, Paul writes somewhere, "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers, and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith as to remove mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but I have not love, I have gained nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant. It is not rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will fail, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. And when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I thought as a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now, we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I have been known. So now, faith, hope, and love abide in these, but the greatest of these is love. So Paul ends by targeting the exact same three things that Solomon does. And he picks love as that which is eternal and ultimate. Everything else, Paul explains, can fail, is meaningless, it's vain, it's unimportant in the absence of love. Now, it's not a selfish love or a disordered one, but it's the very love of God displayed on the cross and sacramentally infused through us as a remedy for the nihilistic malaise from a purely naturalistic focus that can only see what is under the sun and never past it. Now, with the themes of shadow and death versus pastures of life in a place beyond, with the concept that what's below the sun is meaningless and never ultimately satisfying, with the idea that we are trapped on our own without someone to rescue us, and keeping in mind that Solomon loves wisdom, making him, like Plato, a philosopher, a lover of wisdom, well, let's get to the analogy of the cave, probably the most famous thing that Plato ever wrote. And I want you to contrast that with what we've been talking about. Recall, the key to Ecclesiastes is everything is vain under the sun. And the cure is going up to God, following those theological virtues, and finding what is up and above the natural order. Let's read. This is from a translation by Sean Iyer, who I think does a pretty good job. Socrates picks it up and says, "And now allow me to draw a comparison in order to understand the effect of learning, or of the lack thereof, upon our nature. Imagine there are people living in a cave deep underground. The cavern has a mouth that opens to the light above, and a passage exists from this all the way down to the people. They have lived here from infancy, with their legs and necks bound in chains. They cannot move. All they can do is stare directly forward as the chains stop them from turning their heads around. Imagine that far above and behind them blazes a great fire. Between this fire and the captives, a low partition is erected along a path, something like puppeteers used to conceal themselves during their shows." Glaucon says, I can picture it. "Okay, well, look, and you will also see other people carrying objects back and forth along the partition. Things of every kind, images of people and animals carved in stone and wood and other materials. Some of these other people speak while others remain silent." Glaucon responds, "A bizarre situation for some unusual captives." "So we are. Now, tell me, if you suppose it's possible that these captives ever saw anything of themselves or one another, other than the shadows flitting across the cavern wall before them?" Glaucon, "Certainly not, for they're restrained, all their lives with their heads just facing forward only." "And what would be just as true, would that be just as true for the objects moving to and fro behind them?" "Certainly." "Now, if they could speak, would you say that these captives would imagine that the names they give to the things they are able to see apply to real things?" "It would have to be so." "And if a sound reverberated through their cavern from one of those others passing behind the partition, do you suppose that the captives would think anything but the passing shadow was what really made the sound?" Glaucon responds, "No, by Zeus," which I think is a funny expression. "Then undoubtedly such captives would consider the truth to be nothing but the shadows of the carved objects." "Well, most certainly." "Look again and think about what would happen if they were released from these chains and these misconceptions. Imagine one of them is set free from his shackles and immediately made to stand up and bend his neck around, to take steps, to gaze up towards the fire. And all of this was painful, and the glare from the light made him unable to see the objects that cast the shadows he once beheld. What do you think his reaction would be if someone informed him that everything he had formerly known was an illusion and a delusion, but that now he was a few steps closer to reality, oriented now towards things that were more authentic and able to see more truly? And even further, if one would direct his attention to the artificial figures passing to and fro and ask him what their names are, would this man not be at a loss to do so? Would he rather believe that the shadows he formerly knew were more real than the objects now shown to him? Glaucon, much more real. Now, if he was forced to look directly at the firelight, wouldn't his eyes be pained? Wouldn't he turn away and run back to those things which he normally perceived and understand them as more defined and clearly, and then the things now being brought to his attention? Yes, that's right. Now let's say he is forcibly dragged up the steep climb out of the cavern and firmly held until finally he stands in the light of the sun. Don't you think that he would be agitated and even begin to complain? Under that light, would his eyes not be nearly blinded, unable to discern any of the things that we ourselves call real? Well, no, he wouldn't see them at first. It would take time, I suppose, for him to get used to seeing higher things. In the beginning, he might only trace the shadows, then reflections of people and other things in the water. Next, he would come to see the things themselves. Then he would behold the heavenly bodies and the heaven itself by night, seeing the light of the stars and the moon with greater ease than the sun and its light by day. Glaucon, indeed so. And then I think he would at last be able to gaze upon the sun itself, neither as reflected in water nor as a phantom image in some other place, but in its own place as it really is. Undeniably. And now he'll begin to reason. He will find that the sun is the source of the seasons and the years and the governor of all visible things and is ultimately the origin of everything previously known. Well, of course, first he would see and then draw conclusions. That being the case, should he remember his fellow prisoners and their original dwelling and what was accepted as wisdom in that setting? Don't you imagine he would consider himself fortunate for his transformation and feel pity for the captives? Yes, I agree. Now, suppose there were honors and awards amongst the captives, which they granted as prizes to one another for being the best at recognizing the various shadows passing by or deciphering their patterns, their order, the relationship among them, and therefore best at predicting what shadow would be seen next. Do you believe that our liberated man would be much concerned with such honors? Or that he would be jealous of those who received them? Or that he would strive to be like those who were lauded by the captives and enjoyed pride of place among them? Or would rather take Homer's view and rather wish in earthly life to be the humble serf of landless men? And suffer whatever he had to, instead of holding the views of the captives and returning to that state of being? Glaucon, truly he would rather suffer a great deal than return to such a life. Well, here's something else to consider. If such a man would suddenly go from the sunlight to once more descend to his original circumstances, wouldn't his vision be obscured by the darkness? It obviously would. And so let's say he is with the captives and gets put into the position of interpreting the wall shadows. His eyes are still adjusted to the darkness, and it may take a while before they are. Wouldn't he become a laughingstock? Wouldn't they say, "You have returned from your adventure up there and with ruined eyes"? Would they not say that the ascent was a waste of time? And if they had the opportunity, do you suppose that they might raise their hands against him and kill this person who is trying to liberate them to a higher plane? Glaucon, I'm afraid so. Then, my friend Glaucon, this image applies to everything we've been discussing. It compares the visible world to the underground cavern, and the power of the sun to the fire that burnt in the cavern. You won't misunderstand me if you connect the captive's ascent to be the ascent of the soul to the intelligible world. This is how I believe, and I shared it at your wish, though heaven knows whether it is all true. Regardless, it appears to me that in the realm of what we know, the idea of the good is discovered last of all, and it only perceived with great difficulty. But when it is seen, it leads us directly to finding that it is universal cause of all that is right and beautiful. It is the source of visible light and the master of the same. And in the intelligible world, it is the master of truth and reason. And whoever, in private or in public, would behave in a sensible way will keep this idea in focus. I agree, and to the extent I can manage to understand it. Stay with me then for another thought. We should not be surprised that the individuals who have reached this level might be unwilling to spend their time on mundane affairs. For would it not be their souls always feeling a calling to the higher things? If our illustration holds true, that would seem quite likely. Yes, likely indeed. Now, would it be at all surprising for one who has been engaged in the contemplation of holy things, when he ventures into ways of degenerate humanity, to appear ridiculous in his actions? What if, for example, while his eyes are still adjusting to the mundane gloom, he would be forced to appear in court to hold forth about the mere shadows of justice or the other shapes that flitted across the wall, and to engage in debate about such concepts with the minds of others who have never beheld the ideal justice? It would not be a surprise in the least. But one who has his wits about him would remember that there are two things that pain his eyes: being brought from darkness to light and transitioning back from light to darkness. Now consider that the soul experiences the same discomfort. This man would not make light of another when he met with a confused soul. He would take the time to understand if that soul was coming from a luminous realm and his eyes were blinded by darkness, or whether journeying from the darkness of ignorance into an illuminated state had overwhelmed his eyes. One he would consider fortunate. He would pity the other. And if he laughed at either, it would be less justified if he laughed at the expense of the one who is descended from the light above. Well, that's a fitting way to put it. Of course, if I'm correct, then some of our educators are mistaken in their view that it is possible to implant knowledge into a person that wasn't there originally, like vision into the eyes of the blind man. That's what they say. What our message now signifies is that the ability and means of learning is already present in the soul, as the eye could not turn from darkness to light unless the whole body moved. So it is that the mind can only turn around from the world of becoming to that of being by a movement of the whole soul. The whole soul must learn by degrees to endure the contemplation of being in the luminous realms. This is the good. Agreed? Glaucon. Agreed. Thomas Aquinas' fourth way, which sees being, the good, the truth, all of which philosophically convertible into God himself. Agreed. All right, back to Socrates. Therefore, of this matter itself, there must be a craft of some kind which would be most efficient and effective means of transforming the soul. It would not be an art that gives the soul vision, but a craft at labor under the assumption that the soul has its own innate vision, but does not apply it properly. There must be some kind of means for bringing this about. Glaucon. Yes, such a craft must exist. I think that's incredible, guys. And if you didn't catch how that could relate so well to Christ, well, I don't think I can really explain it to you. But I see a lot of beautiful, incredible parallels there. Here's one that you may not have noticed, and that's the role of the fire. I think it plays an interesting role. Here's what I think it may represent. And here's what I think the sun in Ecclesiastes could represent: Satan. So Satan is believed to be a seraphim, meaning literally one of the burning ones. And Satan is called by Paul, I believe in Colossians, the god of this world. And we've done an entire podcast giving 13 reasons why it seems that Lucifer was the angel set in charge of governing nature. So that's something we're going to assume here, which means that everything going on in the natural order is under the dominion of Satan for Solomon. And that artificial burning light that confuses and fools all of the people trapped in the cave, well, that is Lucifer deceiving. And all those people who are puppeteers, those are the powerful people of this world, say the government, the media, etc., who just serve this fire. They feed the fire, and they participate in the deception of those who are held in bondage. Now, that was the sun in Solomon's day, and that's the state of humanity back in Plato's day. But the good news, dear listener, is that Satan was cast down from heaven. The end of the age has come, and, quote, the sun no longer puts forth its light. That's a messianic fulfillment of the great prophecy that no longer are we under the sun. Are we in light of the satanic ruling at all? Because Jesus is now on the throne. And it's with this victorious message that Isaiah announces, and Jesus claims as his own mission, what is written in Isaiah 61, where it says, he unrolled the scroll and found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll, giving it back to the attendant, and sat down, and the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed upon him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." So what does Jesus do? He recovers the lost sight. He frees the prisoners trapped in the cave. He replaces this artificial light, which everybody has learned to love lies, this fire in the cave, with the light of the sun, so that slowly we can begin to witness the light, the truth, the good, and that which is ultimate being himself, so that we can receive the beatific vision of God himself. All right. There you go, guys. That's a wrap. That sounds like a podcast to me. I hope you enjoyed it. Send me an email if you did at thegordianknot101@gmail.com. Of course, do any suggestions. Share this episode. Share any episode with a friend if you could. I do a terrible job promoting it and doing all the regular ways of promotion, so I do rely on word of mouth. I rely on you guys, so please do that. Rate and review if you can. And God bless you all. Keep me in prayer with the little baby David, who's been super good and hasn't screamed one time as I recorded. All right, God bless. Talk to you next episode.